Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. On Friday, we had this conversation with Will County State's Attorney Jim Glasgow and DuPage County State's Attorney Bob Berlin about the Safety Act. And then over the weekend, the implications of the Safety Act, which is set to take effect in Illinois on January 1st, were illustrated once again what it will be. Projecting out what it's going to be. For example, a suburban man who fired a shotgun into a Chicago park early on Thursday had 5 firearms, 1,000 rounds of ammo, and handwritten notes about recent mass shootings as well as critiques of the police involved in those shootings. He's
barely heard about that over the weekend.
He was arraigned on $300,000 cash bail. He had paid a full amount to get out of jail on electronic monitoring. But he only has charges, the only charges pending against him right now, even though this has been referred to FBI, ATF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, due to the nature of the call, the weaponry, the content of the handwritten documents. Chicago police filled out a clear and present danger form. He's charged with 5 felony counts of unlawful use of a weapon. Guess what?
If this is January 2nd, he'd be out?
Yeah. No bail. No cash bail. He would walk. There would be nothing the police could do, prosecutors could do, other than turn him back. That's a non-detainable offense, unlawful use of a weapon.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
This is what Glasgow and Berlin were trying to explain. Jim Glasgow.
The new statute says that bail is abolished. And if that were to take place, I have over 600 prisoners in the Will County Jail. And I also have victims and witnesses who feel secure because of that. If all those individuals are released, and there'd be only maybe about a third of them where we could actually have a hearing for detention, this, if you want an example of what will happen if this law goes into effect, you've got a Petri dish that's been showing you that in Chicago for years.
And he's not one, you know, to suck up media attention or say, look at me. He's coming forward on behalf of the people of Will County to try and keep them safe. And he's a victim himself. Remember when Drew Peterson, and you went over that with him, you know, threatened to kill him or have him killed while he was in prison?
Right, and had Drew Peterson not been in prison facing murder charges, if it was just plotting to kill Jim Glasgow?
He'd be out.
Under the Safety Act, effective Jan 1, could not detain him. Bob Berlin, DuPage County State's Attorney, talking about the implications he sees for his county.
And the unfortunate reality is many of these defendants are going to be released. Many defendants who are charged with serious felonies will be released. And if they don't show up in court, right now it's a felony offense. It's one class lower than what they're charged with. But under the new law, it's a misdemeanor. So you can be on pretrial release for a murder, and if you don't show up in court, it's only a misdemeanor offense.
Right. You're in for a murder. What's a misdemeanor?
We are going to have violent criminals out on the street who cannot be detained. And the research has shown that many of them repeat. They commit more violent offenses, and the public is going to suffer because of that, because judges' hands are tied. There are categories of offenses where even if a person is clearly a threat to the community, a judge will have no ability to detain that person.
I don't know about you, but I don't feel safe with this. And when he was signing it, I mean, it's the size of a Manhattan phone book. You know, he didn't read the darn bill. And he kept shouting, like, this is great. And he had all black lawmakers behind him. I remember it was at Chicago State University. And there's also a snitch line in there, too, folks. If you don't like a cop, you can call this special hotline. That's part of the bill. And it just
make an anonymous complaint.
Right. So there's no proof of it. You just call this hotline, and then that person, and it's easier to sue a police officer as well.
In New York, there's some pushback now against the no cash bail environment in New York City. Over the weekend, four injured after NYPD cops exchanged gunfire with group at Queen's house party. This is Friday night. Watching the party because police were watching the party, plainclothes officers, because they feared there was a potential for violence by some of the local street crews, according to police. And they were right. That's when four people rolled up and opened fire on nearly 100 partygoers, some of who shot back. Then undercover officers fired 14 shots.
But it sounded like the Wild West.
The West wasn't so wild, more like a scene from Heat. Two of the suspected shooters who opened fire on the party.
Oh, let me guess. They had electronic monitoring or out on no cash bail?
Out on charges in other cases, including a robbery and a gun case. It's interesting how the left likes to pass gun control laws, but they don't like to enforce them. Have you noticed that? The head of detectives, the Detectives Endowment Association in NYC. Make no mistake, the lives of detectives are in grave danger when they go to work in the city. The politicians, prosecutors, and judges who are releasing violent people back into the streets, combined with failed laws like Raise the Age, are endangering the very detectives who arrest these recidivists and the New Yorkers they courageously serve, and these officials remain as unaccountable as the criminals. Does that sound familiar at all? Could that statement be applied to any other city, any other politicians, prosecutors, and judges you know in your neighborhood here, for example? The other thing is you're just not going to have police arresting people, period. Well, one, because under the law, they can't, for example, with respect to Class B and C misdemeanors.
With Class B and C misdemeanors, the police will not be able to actually arrest the person. They have to give them a citation with a notice to appear in court within 21 days. Unless the person poses an obvious threat to the community or any person. Again, a very high burden to prove. Otherwise, these people have to just be ticketed and released.
And Class B and C misdemeanors would include what sorts of crimes?
Criminal trespass is one of them. So a person, let's say, refuses to leave a restaurant, but he's not being very disorderly. The police can go there, ask him to leave. If he won't leave, all they can do is write him a ticket, and then the person doesn't have to leave. They police will not be able to physically remove that person unless they can prove that they're an obvious threat to the community.
And then Lori Lightfoot will have a press conference and say, hey, businesses, you're not doing enough to provide for a secure environment.
Right. Step up. Do your part.
That's how that goes.
That's what she says all the time.
You heard it on Mike Scott's news at the top of the hour. Violence on the CTA, level not seen in more than a decade. Yeah. The number of violent crimes on the CTA.
And now they're going to bring back the canine unit on there.
That's no safer than the MTA. And by the way, we'll get to this at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour when the former chief of detectives for the Chicago Police Department, 30 years on the job, Eugene Roy, joins us. But what the Chicago Police Department is doing, because they've got 2,000 fewer officers than they did when Lori Lightfoot took office, is robbing Peter to pay Paul when it comes to the CTA, when it comes to beat cops in district versus specialized units like gang task forces. he's going to explain what's going on and how untenable it is. So, you know, it's really interesting. Pritzker and Lightfoot, you know, they defund police. It's the wrong terminology. You know, they sort of slow walked and deflected during the height of BLM in 2020 and the calls to defund the police. And the calls for violence against police, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, and other fun chants from that enlightened crowd. So they sort of, oh, we're not, you know, we need police and this and that. Well, and then through the back door, what did they do? They depopulated the police, which is the same thing.
They provided an unsafe work environment, and they're like, I'm leaving. Why would I risk going to jail to do my job?
So they got rid of 2,000 police officers in the city, and then they passed the Safety Act.
And Fox 32 is reporting that 180 officers who've been battling crime with the narcotics and gang unit are going back to their districts or going to mass transit, the CTA.
Yeah, well, that's what that's I was talking about, talking to paying, about. Right. Paying, robbing Peter to pay Paul, and we'll get into the details. But understand what they did. They are defund the police. They are non-prosecution of violent criminals. They say one thing from the podium, and then they turn around and what is the state of the police department, you know, in the real world? What is the state of the rule of law in the real world? The chanters and the looters did less damage than your elected officials, your mayor, your governor.
The more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Talking about violent crime, the Safety Act, before Mike Scott's newscast. Updating some other things going on in Illinois, some real exciting news, you know, with respect to our major industries. State regulators finally passed around a new batch of pot dispensary licenses. On Friday, 149 cannabis dispensary license to more than double the number of pot shops statewide.
Because we need more of those.
Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's going to save us.
A story from NPR, Illinois now a destination for abortion providers. Missouri Democrats over the weekend calling on Illinois to help pay for abortions from Missouri residents that are going to cross over to have an abortion. So there you go. Two of our big industries, abortion and dope.
Yeah, Mayor Lightfoot was touting, too, we have more than, you know, close to $1 million to help people from out of state come here to do their abortion business. And she said business.
Uh-huh. Do they have to be vaccinated?
Oh, well, they should be, shouldn't they? Especially if they're going to a healthcare facility.
Well, I'm just asking. I know she's real big on the vaccine mandates. Maybe somebody could ask Triple Threat about the vax status of those coming in from other states.
So vaccine mandates for city workers, cops, firefighters, teachers.
Mm-hmm. And in the governor's race, this is the latest back and forth between Jelly Belly and Darren Bailey. Jelly Belly put up a new ad that accuses Darren Bailey of hypocrisy, being opposed to government benefits, but taking farm subsidies and PPP. Take a listen to the ad, then we'll have Bailey's response.
Guess who's really paying for Darren Bailey's campaign for governor? You are. Yes, you are. Follow along. Darren Bailey's taken over $2 million in government money. The same Darren Bailey who acts like he's against government support. And Bailey got caught taking a fortune in PPP money just weeks before giving $150,000 to his campaign. So he's running for governor courtesy of you. And Darren Bailey didn't even say thank you.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
So really, I'm paying for Darren Bailey's campaign?
Mm-hmm. So there's two things there. One is the farm subsidies. The other is the PPP. Let's take them in turn, shall we? The PPP money, did you hear that, Illinois businesses? You're supposed to thank Governor Pritzker and, I guess, the politicians at the federal level. You're supposed to thank them for the payroll protection money that you got when they shut down your business. Thank you. Otherwise, obviously, you're ungrateful. I shut down your business. We talked about this ad nauseum during the pandemic.
For years.
I take your business, government, and then I offer compensation, which, by the way, is constitutionally acquired. It's a de facto eminent domain play that the government did, I would argue, and I did, and I still do. And now, Darren Bailey, and by extension, every other business that took PPP money, owes the political class a thank you. Isn't that the implication of the ad?
Yep.
I think so. You know, on the farm subsidies piece of it, and by the way, got away with taking the PPP money. What do you mean got away with it?
He applied for it like everybody else.
Did he commit
businesses?
Did he commit a crime?
No.
I don't believe he's been accused of committing a crime. So what did he get away with? Accessing a program that was set up by the government to compensate people for taking their businesses? But, you know, by shutting them down? Huh. Well, I suppose, you know, that's understandable given the source of the criticism. Somebody that runs around pretending like he's a businessman, like he's a tech entrepreneur, when in point of fact,
he's never had a job in his life.
Right.
Ever.
And that's Darren Bailey's response in pertinent part.
Friends, I wanted to take a moment to address out-of-touch billionaire JB's latest attack. Get this. JB Pritzker has the gall to run a TV ad attacking me for running a business and doing whatever it takes to keep people employed during tough times. JB Pritzker, you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. You inherited billions of dollars from your family. You have millions stashed away on islands that most folks have never heard of, let alone visited. You've never woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat worrying about keeping a job or managing payroll. You've literally never worked a day in your life. And you're criticizing me for how I run my farm? How dare you? You're the trust fund kid on the school playground pushing all the regular kids around and making fun of their bagged lunches. You're the guy who ignores the speed limit on your custom-made, one-of-a-kind boat while the rest of us worry about the price of gas. Let me tell you what a hard day's work looks like. It's waking up before the sun comes up to pack 18 hours of hard physical labor into a single day during harvest. It's putting on your work boots, running tractors, plowing fields, and bandaging up calloused hands so that you can wake up the following day and do it all over again. It's worrying about crops when the weather is too dry, too wet, too hot, or too cold. It's exhaustion in every bone in your body, but knowing that people and jobs depend on you to keep putting one foot in front of the other. All over Illinois, there are people like me, farmers, yes, but also truck drivers, plumbers, electricians, grocery workers, mechanics, and so many others who put in the hours and sweat to provide for their families. These regular working folks make our state great, and they'll be the driving force behind our state's recovery. people like you and your Gold Coast friends are running our home into the ground. Governor Pritzker, you're spending millions of dollars of your family's money to attack me for how I run my business, the business that I built with my own two hands. You sit around with your soft hands laughing with your snooty friends at the downstate farmer who thinks that he can make a difference. Well, you got one thing wrong. I don't think I can make a difference. I know I can make a difference because I know what it takes to work hard and build something, and you don't have a clue.
Bailey has struggled in the last month since the primary, but that's starting to get his feet underneath him. That's a good response. That's on point. And, I mean, I love the, you know, my hands, farmer, your soft hands, you doughy do-nothing. Yeah, that's right. And standing with people who work for a living that Pritzker looks down upon. Absolutely. And frankly, the rest of the political ruling class did. The same people that put Trump in office, Republicans and Democrats, that see a ruling class that despises them, political ruling class that despises them. They still do. Some of the names have changed. The attitude's the same.
So true.
And that's the question. That's what those people will decide on November 8th. Do you want to continue to tolerate being hurt economically, in many cases physically, because of the lawlessness we've talked about at some length, or then ridiculed on top of it? Or is it time to, give a farmer a try, if you will?
And parents never forget what he did to your children. While all of our neighboring states were at school in 2020, 2021, which I know seems like a lifetime ago, don't forget that, because he could do it all over again in an instant. I don't trust him. I don't like him. And Darren Bailey was spot on. He has never worked a day in his life, and he was born with a silver spoon, which is fine. But
silver shovel.
But that does, but he's not doing the right thing for Illinoisans. And the Safety Act that we've gone over and we're going to keep going over is just an example of why you can't let him continue with this tyranny that he's had.
That doesn't get to doubling the state's gas tax, attempting to increase your income taxes. I mean, again, the average family, $2,100 plus, you're paying out more in taxes than you were 4 years ago when he took office. Does that matter to you? I don't know.
A lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck and work very hard, and we're getting squashed.
I mean, $2,100, that was like one of those relief payments during COVID. So, yeah. I mean, it was a big deal when it was a relief payment. Is it a big deal when it's being extracted from you by the governor and his ilk?
And don't be fooled by the, you know, the school supply tax holiday. Whoop-de-doo. You go play from 6% to 1%.
Help. And in terms of the farm subsidy thing, I mean, that's really, boy, that takes some stones, lack of consciousness, or lack of conscience, I should say, to make this claim. The way that he recklessly and fecklessly spends other people's money. But the whole farm subsidies thing, or accessing a migrant worker program and this and that, these criticisms that were lodged against Bailey in the primary. You know, you play by the rules of the game. You want to change the rules of the game, I'm all for it. But it's like with student loans. Oh, you know, you're against the federal government being in the business of dominating, you know, being the sole source effectively of student loans and subsidizing student loans. And then, you know, you go to college and you take out a student loan. Hey, these are the rules of the game. You want to change them? Fine, let's change them. Let's talk about changing them. But don't set the rules of the game and then I play by them and then I'm the bad guy. It doesn't work that way. There's no hypocrisy here. Except as it pertains to
them.
Yeah. Spalding. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. You're absolutely right about everything, but you got to look at this idiot. You know, he's on tape trying to buy a Senate seat from Blagojevich. He's trying to screw the guy born with a $3 billion bank account is trying to screw the state of Illinois out of tax money, gets caught doing it, says, oh, I'm sorry, pays it, and he still gets voted in. Nobody's going to care about this. You know, Amy, what you said about remember what he did to your kids? The guy's already spending millions of dollars to diss Bailey as it is now, and he's going to get real. The idiots, and it's just like Lori Lightfoot will be back. I just don't get it.
We'll see. Thanks for the call, Marty. Don't be so sure. Glenn, South Suburbs.
Okay, just wanted to comment.
Yeah.
Two candidates, both farmers, running for the governorship. One, a grain farmer. The other, a horse farmer. The grain farmer cultivating fields to feed people. The horse farmer mucking out stables and spreading the muck all over the state for the last 3.5 years. Number two, does Pritzker get any tax reductions for breeding horses? Because they are very lucrative reductions. Mm. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Glenn. Karen and Beecher.
Good morning. I think I've calmed down since I talked to your screener. But I wanted to make sure that you don't have the Oompa Loompa sound effect going on in my voice like on Friday.
No, you're good. You're back to normal. Munchkin, yes. Yeah.
Oh, thank God. Okay, so Dan, I have been going through this very same instance with my husband. You know, he owns a small family-owned restaurant here and been around for about 50 years. And I, too, when I called you about the student loans, and I was adamant that people have to pay those back. They knew what the terms of those student loans were, as I did, and I paid mine back. My husband, too. I think everybody needed to pay back their student loans. But then people came back to me and said, oh, Karen, you think everybody needs to pay back their student loans, but you and your husband get to sit back on everybody's welfare and run your little restaurant. Well, no. Let me tell you, this was money that was offered to my husband. This was money that was offered through, like you said, all these state-run and federal programs. And it really, quite frankly, it was probably our money anyway.
Wait. Your husband's business was shut down.
Oh yes, absolutely.
That's the end of the story. That is the end of the story. That is in terms of responding to that sort of criticism. That's the end of the story. The government took our business.
They took your livelihoods.
End of story. That's all you need to say in response, Karen.
Well, I want them. Dan, the teacher in me, though. I want them to get from A to Z. And I want them to know this was our money to begin with through taxes and different belonging to different agencies. My husband and I read all the terms, and we played by the rules. And you should have seen the hoops and the loops we had to jump through. Yet we did it. And he did it. He went without a paycheck for a year to make sure that his employees and all of his purveyors, he reinvented his restaurant. He opened up his Aunt Mary's grocery store, an old Italian grocery store in the banquet room.
Yeah, well,
he did wonderful things.
And Karen, now, per Governor Pritzker, please send a thank you note to the state and to the federal government for all that they did for you. Thanks for the call, Karen.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, the last shoe to drop dropped. That would be Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema. She of the thigh-high boots.
Yes. Yeah. Right. The Kinky Boots Club. Yes, I remember it well.
Right. Those boots were made for taxing. She got her 1% excise tax on stock buybacks. So layering another tax increase. And they got that minimum corporate tax as well.
15% for companies worth $1 billion or more.
And that was good enough to get everybody on board, even though Bernie Sanders, of all people, who voted for it, nonetheless noted that he's concerned this won't do anything to address inflation. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act.
Because it doesn't.
The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, this is their estimate. In calendar year 2022, enacting the bill would have a negligible effect on inflation. In calendar year 2023, inflation would probably be between 1/10 of a point lower and 1/10 of a point higher under the bill than it would be under current law.
Right. I mean, there isn't a single thing in the bill that lowers gas prices that helps Americans pay their groceries or reduce the cost of living. Nothing.
So
why was the urgency, 24-hour marathon session over the weekend and VP Kamala Harris, with the tiebreaker?
So
important.
The Inflation Reduction Act may, according to the CBO, have the net effect of marginally increasing inflation over the next year. That's what they call inflation reduction, a potential increase, and certainly a negligible reduction, if any whatsoever. But that's not Pagliacci's spin on it. He was positively effusive in celebrating the passage.
We changed the world.
We are elated. No. Every member of my caucus is elated about what happened, because we've changed the world.
Oh, boy. Oh,
yeah,
we did very highly of themselves.
Did something really important. It's always seminal, the courage to spend other people's money and pick winners and losers in the energy sector and so forth. The courage that takes. They did the work, and they do it every day.
It's God's work, really. Yeah,
they did the work to extract from you the benefits of your work. Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business, joins us now. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So how much did they change the world, Jim?
The last 2.5 years, and I guess this is pretty much our whole lifetime, we look at a situation that could be spiraling negatively, and we say to ourselves, well, we could come out of this spin, provided that the government doesn't do anything stupid like A, whatever that fill-in A is. And pretty much every time over the last 2.5 years, they do that. When I read, before I saw anything about this bill, the second I saw it was called the Inflation Reduction Act, I came to the conclusion that it would not only do nothing to fight inflation, but most probably spur inflation, which is obviously what it's done. Just increasing spending right now is ridiculous. The part of it that's a transfer to green energy, you absolutely know that it's going to increase regulation somehow on fossil fuel companies. The stock buyback part, that's sickening to me that the government feels so comfortable in telling us who can own what. And even though it seems like a small thing to people, make no mistake about it, it's a slippery slope that we're halfway down already. The IRS agent part of it, just the thing that dawned on me this morning.
Didn't even get to that.
Yeah, 87,000 new IRS agents. Are they going to be armed?
Yeah, right.
They've been weaponized in the past, right? You go.
The IRS, I mean, Ted Cruz, I think, had the definitive statement on it. The IRS will now be larger than the Pentagon, the FBI, the State Department, and border security combined. And that's of course only to ensure fat cats the returns of fat cats are properly vetted. Right. Sure.
Can I address that real quick?
Yeah.
This is how this plays out for those people who don't understand psychology. When you start to go after fat cats, guess what you're met with, which is a team of lawyers and accountants, and it becomes very, very difficult and frustrating, is my guess, for IRS agents. So what happens in a couple of years then when they're starting to need to justify this huge, huge increase, and they can't get the fat cats as easily as they thought they would? They are going to come down for the less fat cat. We know this. We've seen this play out a million times. So to me, it's a frustrating bill. Again, all I thought is just please don't do anything stupid, and then bam, disappointed again.
Yeah, on the stock buyback, just on this, because it's so demagogued as like, you know, some way that C-suiters enrich themselves. In practice, it actually hurts the smaller growing business, doesn't it? They're looking for new funding, and those companies are responsible for a lot of American innovation. Tyler Cohen, economist George Mason, said, "Are you worried about corporations being too big and monopolistic? This makes it harder for them to shrink. Think of it also as a tax on the reallocation of capital to new and growing endeavors."
Oh, and there's no question that that's the case. But I think there's one thing that trumps that a little bit is that, remember when stock buybacks happen the most, it's like a big company is making a commentary on the macroeconomic condition of the country when they say there's really not better ways for me to spend my money than to borrow and buy back or just buy back on its own. So what the government is saying right now is that they're taking the pressure off themselves to create a better environment for expansion and for CapEx. And they're saying, like, well, instead of – it's like, remember when the city of Chicago made the law that to be a city of Chicago employee, you had to live in the city limits? Well, instead of addressing the problem of why the city of Chicago wasn't a good and attractive place to live for these people, they just go right away to the symptom and try to crack down on it. And to me, it's such a bad way to do it. But to your point, absolutely it does.
All right, so Democrats say this is going to slow global warming. Is there a plan? Did they mention anything in the bill of how they're going to achieve that?
Well, it's all the subsidies. That's what they say.
But what's...
It's called the Inflation Reduction Act, and they're touting touting climate change. Yeah, right.
So why not call it the Climate Change Act instead of the Inflation Reduction Act?
Because you can't call a bill what it's actually supposed to do.
Correct.
Because then you can't catch anybody voting against it. It's like the Anti-Killing Puppies Act.
Right.
If you vote against it, of course, you're terrible. But no, the notion, this is Build Back Better, just repackaged and put out there. And, you know, the focus groups meeting they have on their side with a bunch of guys sitting around saying, what are people worried about? Inflation. Okay, so let's call it the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, really, as I look at it, I see one out of the multitude of things that someday could help against inflation by increasing taxes on corporations, which, by the way, let's break that down for a second, too. The problem right now is demand outstripping supply, right? So taxing, going after the big company, the suppliers, do you think that's going to make their supply come to market faster, cheaper, and more efficiently? Obviously not. So it's like the opposite. However, in the long term, if you truly do enough damage to the economy, you will help with the inflation problem, if that's really what you want to do. I thought we were taking a tax to not destroy the economy too much to decrease demand, but clearly they've decided to go another path.
Right, that's it, right. If you put a tourniquet on demand because of the hammering that you deliver. I mean, keep things simple. You want less investment but more supply, because when you tax investment, you're going to get less of it. But you want more supply from less investment. Is that how it works?
Sure. Yeah. And put a tax on supply and then hope that somehow the supply is going to increase. I don't know. Like, you look back at it and you obviously that's going to, if anything, have a slight positive effect on inflation, meaning it's going to spur inflation a little more. So the only real debatable concept of it is it on purpose to try to cause problems that they need to ride into their white horse and fix? Or is it just unintentional? Or is it that level of incompetence? And that's the thing that keeps me up at night.
Well, you know how this is, you see the reporting. It's a wonderful legislative achievement. You know, if you pass something, it could be the kill puppies bill. But we passed it. That's an achievement. We achieved something. Now, what the impact will be, what the consequences, well, don't worry about that. We came together and we changed the world, in the immortal words of Pagliacci there. I mean, it's just, right. I mean, it's just beating your head against a wall.
Well, what about something? Is there anything positive? I mean, what about Medicare? Because now they can directly negotiate with drug companies.
And price controls.
Lower costs for prescriptions for seniors. Yeah. So how's that going to go?
Do price controls reduce costs, Jim?
They never have in the past reduced costs. I'm for negotiating. But when it's Medicare, Medicaid, it seems like it's too big a leverage position. But anyway, to negotiate, because then it becomes price controls. And then, like, just the price controls thing that people think is a good idea is a completely asinine idea. Just to give a quick example of it, like when a state like Oregon right now is deciding on price controls for rent control. So automatically, just when the discussion begins, developers start to pull back from the area. And it is very, very quickly that prices go up just because of the conversation of rent controls, let alone the actual passage of the legislation. It's the same thing everywhere else. If you start pointing fingers at people saying, oh, you can only charge this for this, well, then new suppliers don't come to the market. This is like, it's not even that complicated an economic equation. It's really like a half a derivative away from the headline, and yet they don't expect people to actually think that far down.
Does $750 billion more on the pyre, does this change the thinking, impact the thinking of Jay Powell and the Fed mystics at all, do you think, when it comes to rates over the next quarters?
I thought it would, but it doesn't seem to this morning yet, unless the market hasn't had time to digest the full ramifications of it. The one thing that I did see is the yield curve steepened, inverted a little bit more, which is 2-year notes versus 10-year. And it's gone a little bit negative. And the takeaway of that is that the odds of a recession happening soon have gone up a tiny bit. But it's still just at this next meeting, the market is saying that the Fed is relatively resolved to go 75 basis points. There's right now a 69% chance that at the next meeting, which is 6 weeks away, by the way, and all this talk of what the Fed's going to do. Remember, we are 2 days in front of an absolutely huge CPI number that's coming out on the 10th. Which is Wednesday. So all this is probably premature. The fact that the market didn't have much of a bigger move on it is probably a function of the fact that we're looking at a huge number on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. So waiting, holding your breath, and seeing what happens. And then, you know, a year from now, we'll come back like we did a year ago and say, yeah, how is that going, when Joe Biden famously said, you know, if my policy, if we don't reduce inflation, if it's not transitory, then we'll look back and say, well, you know, that was foolish what we did. Well, that's what we're saying now. And now we'll have to wait another year to do the same thing with this measure, I suppose.
And that's what really frustrates people who, and I'm not saying I'm any kind of economic genius, but there's a huge pool of people like a year and a half ago was saying, well, if you don't stop buying mortgage-backed bonds right now and you don't start raising rates, you're going to get into a deep, deep recessionary spiral. And now they come out and say, like, but who really could have seen that coming? And all of us look at each other like, well, what are you talking about? Pretty much everyone could have seen this coming. We were screaming at you at the top of our lungs 15 to 18 months ago saying real estate is going through the roof, and yet you're still buying $40 billion of mortgage-backed bonds per month to try to support the real estate market. Everything we're feeling right now is a completely self-inflicted wound, and it's the height of frustration.
Jim Urio, frustrated Jim Urio, Fox Business Analyst, also the owner of Brandt's Restaurant.
I haven't been there in a while. Do you miss us?
Palatine.
Yeah, well, I have noticed you not being there, and you usually come, once a month in the summer, and
right.
You haven't been there. What's the problem?
Yeah, right.
Oh,
yeah.
We're eating at home because it's cheaper.
Keep her table roped off. She'll be there.
I will. It still has a velvet rope around
it. Yes.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate
it. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.proanswer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. See the world premiere of Uncle Tom 2 on August 25th. Get your tickets at 560theanswer.com/movie.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. going to try and, from a layman's perspective, civilian perspective, to get an understanding of what's happening within the Chicago Police Department as part of the larger conversation about law enforcement. So Chicago Police Department and, of course, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and also federal law enforcement, too, as part of this effort or lack of effort to quell violent crime in the city. So we thought we'd talk to somebody who knows, who had 30-plus years on the job, who retired as the chief of detectives at the Chicago Police Department. He's Eugene Roy, and he joins us now. Eugene Roy, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So why don't we start with the news that we were discussing a bit earlier in the program, and Mike Scott's been discussing on his newscast about the repurposing of police officers to districts and to CTA and away from specialized units. What's going on there?
The department on late last week announced that it was moving a number of officers from the gang investigation section to back to patrol and to the unit that patrols the CTA. What that means is people that were working on gang violence in Chicago will be returned to uniform patrol instead of investigations, and that puts a serious crimp in the investigation of gang-related crimes. Now, that's important because the violence in Chicago has historically been driven by gangs seeking or fighting for control of the lucrative drug markets in Chicago.
Well, then who's left investigating the gang crimes and murders in Chicago?
Well, you have the homicide detectives in the areas that will be investigating the actual murders, but we're losing that expertise that the gang investigators have built up over the years. Let's put it this way. When we talk about investigating gangs and narcotics, there's two parts to that. The first part is, what we traditionally expect out of narcotics, people making undercover buys, executing search warrants, attempting to find large quantities coming into the city and to interdict them. The second side of that, and what the gang specialists were excellent at, was developing informants, getting information about things that were going to happen before they happen, developing informants. Also, their investigative strategies were different. They had many close relationships with other law enforcement agencies, including federal task forces, and they would investigate the crimes, the underlying crimes that fuel the narcotic sales. I'm talking about money laundering, witness intimidation, purchasing weapons, selling weapons. So we're losing that. And that's critical.
So it seems to me like we're just playing whack-a-mole here, that we've got a 10-year high number of violent crimes on the CTA, so we need more officers of the CTA, we need more officers in district, but that means you're taking away officers from, particularly with specialized knowledge that you were just describing, from the what should be the focus, because they're responsible for most of the violence, and that's the street gangs. So the net of this is we have a lack of personnel to do all of these above jobs?
Absolutely. Let me throw out a couple of numbers. The end of calendar year 2019, there were 13,100 approximately police officers on the CPD payroll. The end of last year, there were only 11,800. That's a net loss of over 1,200 officers. We consider that there's about approximately 300 officers assigned to a district. That's the equivalent of closing four districts in the city of Chicago. On top of that, besides the retirements, which are a normal function of an agency like the Chicago Police Department, Fire Department, any other agency, you have last year there were 264 officers who resigned from the police department. That means they left the police department before they were eligible for a pension. They're seeking other employment, and most of them are ending up going to work with other law enforcement agencies, some here in the Chicago area and some at other places across the country. Now, that's critical because those people are people that have gone past their training. They're years away from retirement. They have the knowledge and skills that they need to do the job effectively and safely. And it's like the term journeyman that the union uses. You only require minimal supervision. You can do your job. You can be counted on to do your job. You lose that sort of experience. That's critical. It hurts.
So what are the officers saying? I mean, Fox 2 reporting that 180 have been told, you know, that are on the gang and narcotics unit to choose between going back to their districts or to protect the CTA. Do you know what choices they're making and what's their reaction to all of this?
They feel betrayed. They feel dismayed. And let's not forget either, besides being police officers, they also have family that live and work in Chicago. People who aren't safe in the neighborhoods where they reside. People who aren't safe riding the L at this time. They feel betrayed. They're very upset. The manner in which it was done, the timing is very clumsy at best. There may be a number of contract violations involved here. So it's just going to muddy the waters even further. And you want people that are out there that want to come to work. They're excited, enthusiastic, motivated, want to go out and do the job, the right way to protect people. And they've been doing that, and they've been taken away from it.
And what are the staffing levels in some of the most violent districts in the city that this is, I guess, in part supposed to address?
There's just not enough cops to go around. It's very basic. One particular district that I know of, a very violent district, there's supposed to be 15 beat cars every watch on the midnight shift. There's times lately, and it's multiple times over the past year, where instead of having 15 beat cars and at least three sergeants to supervise them, to have the span of control and supervision that the consent decree calls for and good policing calls for, there may only be one sergeant to supervise 9 cars, 8 cars out of 15. That's not safe for the officers, and it's not safe for the community.
So you're down, like in a violent district, you're describing you're down a third to a half of the officers that you need patrolling the streets.
Absolutely.
And so let's talk about something else, too, that gets some attention, and I think your knowledge on this would be helpful. Clearance rates. You know, you see the reports about murder clearance rates of 20% or less. What are the factors that go into what seems to be a very low number of murder cases being cleared, people being caught and prosecuted?
It's a number of factors. First of all, it's the overwhelming the numbers, the intensity of the violence. You know, we've got detectives running from case to case to case. That's one factor. The next factor is, we'll be very candid about it, there's a lack of cooperation and communication from the community, some of it for good reason. They're fear the people that are witnesses, fear retaliation, they fear harassment. That's a problem. And we have no effective witness protection or relocation program, despite what the state's attorney's office claims, to protect people. We can't assure people with any degree of certainty that if they cooperate with the police, that they and their families are going to be protected and looked after. That really is a huge factor. And one of the other bigger factors, focusing on the state's attorney's office, is the tense relationship between the state's attorney's office and the police department, especially the detectives that are putting the case together. Anytime you have detectives bringing a case to the state's attorney's office, for prosecution through felony review, there's always going to be a certain amount of creative tension. And I'm sure you have the same thing when you sit down with your staff and plan your show for the next day. Ideas are exchanged. How do we make something better? How do we accomplish what we need to do? How do we do it the right way? Well, unfortunately, that creative tension has ratcheted up and has become an acidic relationship. And it really impacts on the quality of the investigations. And it throws up roadblocks to the detectives who are working literally around the clock to solve murders and put bad guys in jail.
Well, what grade would you...
The former head of felony review, Jim Murphy, resigned last week. And in his resignation letter, he essentially said, talking about that tension you're describing, said political narratives have become more important than essentially, I'm not quoting him verbatim, but essentially said political narratives have become more important than getting justice for the victims of crime.
I agree with Jim 100%. Jim is one of the good guys. It's really a tragic loss for the people of Cook County and for the members of the police department, the other law enforcement agencies that have worked with him down through the years. He is right on the money. What we see is we see this headlong rush towards HB 3653, the Reform Act. We have people that are repeat violent offenders, gun offenders, that are being caught with more guns. And the state's attorney either refuses to prosecute them or they do get arrested and they go in front of a judge. And as long as they didn't shoot anybody, they are given a, you know, a get out of jail free card, literally. I mean, they either get a signature bond or no cash bond required and they walk out and they're back doing what they were doing when they got caught with the gun. Now, that's important. You ask any police officer, why is gun enforcement critical to public safety? And it's because any experienced police officer will tell you that a convicted felon carries a gun for only one of two reasons. Number one, to rob somebody, or number two, to shoot somebody. As long as there's no teeth, these people, these offenders know that if they do get caught with a gun, they're going to get a laugh. They're going to laugh at the system, and they're going to get they're going to spend overnight in jail, and they're going to be cut loose the next morning. There's no consequences for carrying a weapon on the part of a convicted felon.
What kind of job do you think Superintendent Brown is doing? And does he have any respect among the rank and file?
You know, that's always something bosses bosses never get. They get all the blame, none of the credit. I think the jury is still out on Superintendent Brown. I know he's at a critical point in his tenure here.
I want to just, you were on the job for 30 years, talking to Eugene Roy, former chief of detectives for Chicago Police Department, on the job for 30 years. So you've seen crime spikes before in the 80s and 90s. Is what's happening in Chicago now different than what we've experienced previously? And if so, how?
It is different because of the various factors. You know, we have a state's attorney's office that is not only taking on water every day, but it's sinking. There's an exodus of the top leadership, the people who are the experienced professionals who make things happen. Another critical loss from there, besides Jim, there were another five mid to high level attorneys who left in the past month. And also the director of investigations for the state's attorney's office left on relatively short notice. So that's one of the key problems. There is just there's a lack of integrity either. You know, the Jesse Smollett case. Don't need to revisit it here in the time we have available. But the Jesse Smollett case speaks for itself.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, one of the things that you're sort of getting to that I just want to underscore is the predators in our society, they pay attention. They see what people, they hear what people say, in charge. They see what people do. We had, for example, a very high-profile case a couple of weeks ago where police witnessed a murder, gave chase to the suspect, and then they were called off that chase. And the dispatch that became public, we talked about it in this program, once they were called off pursuing that murder suspect, you had one Chicago police officer say over the air that this department is a joke. Well, what kind of statement is that when you're hearing that from coming from police? And I'm not blaming him. I'm just saying, you know, that's something that people take notice of.
That what you're hearing is you're hearing the voice of frustration on the part of the police officers. They want to do the job. Here you have people that are putting their lives on the line, risking their lives, their livelihood, their families, to go out and arrest somebody who's just committed a violent crime, and they're prohibited from doing so. Now, I don't know all the circumstances of why the supervisor terminated the chase, so I don't want to criticize the supervisor, but I will raise questions about the mindset where people in supervisory capacities are stopping the police from doing their job, what they're sworn to do. Now, chases are very dangerous. I understand that. I get that. I was responsible for a number of them during my career. It's a critical decision that has to be made in a matter of seconds under conditions of minimal information. But the mindset has to be with the police department instead of worrying about, does this fit the criteria of a multiple-page policy, or does it fit the criteria of there's some people out here just committed a murder, just shot into a group of people. We need to arrest these people before they do some more. You know, you have to err on the side of, you know, public safety.
Well, if the Safety Act takes effect January 1st, then this will be cleared up because the police won't be allowed to chase in that circumstance.
A community that doesn't protect itself is bound to fall.
And what's your from you know, talking to law enforcement, your understanding of this legislation? We talked about it at some length with Will County and DuPage County State's attorneys last week. What do you see as the impact on policing of that law?
I think you're going to see a further reduction in the proactive efforts by police officers, which are already on the low end. They're going to sink even lower. And instead of having people out there, instead of having guardians who are looking for crime and are looking to prevent crime and before it happens and keep their communities and the public safe, you're going to see a generation of report takers. And report takers don't prevent crimes. They only document them.
He is Eugene Roy. He's the former chief of detectives for the Chicago Police Department. Eugene Roy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Thank you, and we'd love to have you back. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked a bit on Friday about FBI Director Christopher Wray's testimony on the Hill on a range of topics. Didn't get to all of it, though, but in particular, the discussion of the ongoing investigation into Hunter Biden, which we know now is ongoing, even though it's a little bit difficult to get any more information than ongoing. John Kennedy, senator from Louisiana, queried Christopher Wray about these agents. For Russian collusion, it was Strzok and Page. Remember the lovebirds?
Oh, that's right. How are those two kits doing?
Well, for Hunter Biden, it's Tebow and Auten.
Okay.
These are the FBI agents that were identified in a whistleblower letter to Senator Chuck Grassley as having worked to essentially inhibit the Hunter Biden investigation by characterizing actual evidence as disinformation.
Of course.
And this was Senator Kennedy's push on that topic.
Isn't it true that Mr. Tebow, Agent Tebow, excuse me, and FBI Supervisory Intelligence Analyst Brian Otan covered up derogatory information about Mr. Hunter Biden while working for the FBI?
Well, again, I want to be very careful not to interfere with ongoing personnel matters. I should say that when I read the letter that describes the kinds of things that you're talking about, I found it deeply troubling. And
it is troubling.
And it is totally...
And it's not about their political beliefs.
Right.
It's not about their political beliefs. It's about that this is a senior employee at the FBI with years of experience going on social media and tweeting this kind of stuff.
So I have, since I started in...
Which gives the people the impression that there is bias, whether there is or there isn't.
I feel very strongly, and I have communicated consistently since I started as director, that our folks need to make sure that they're not just doing the right thing, that they're doing it in the right way, and that they avoid even the appearance of bias or lack of objectivity.
This man had been with the FBI for 25 years. He's now on leave. He did this kind of stuff as recently as last month. Do you know how this looks to the American people?
I will tell you that what you're describing is not representative of the FBI that I see up close every day in this country.
Kennedy was also talking about social media posts that were political in nature. But, of course, the more serious allegation is the professional... the abrogation of their professional duties, perhaps even criminal conduct, if they were trying to obstruct an investigation that the director of the FBI says is ongoing. And this came after a week after you had the Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson before a House committee on the same topic. Well, partly on the same topic, the Hunter Biden investigation. And Matt Gaetz, you know, whatever you think of Matt Gaetz, he's a bit of a blunt instrument. I get it. But when he makes a point that's substantive, then he sticks on that point. And I think he made a couple of substantive points in this exchange with Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson, the head of national security, point man for national security at DOJ. Keep that in mind.
Is Hunter Biden a national security threat?
That's not a question that would come up before me, Congressman.
You're the head of the National Security Division, so it seems sort of on the nose.
It's not in my practice or experience to identify individuals
not in my purview.
And to
We've
label
heard that
any individual, an American citizen or any individual, as a national security threat.
Well, you would certainly concede that if the adult offspring of the President of the United States or the Vice President were compromised, that would be a national security threat, right?
We speak through our filings in court, and we speak through our actions in open court. So,
And on the laptop, for those still trying to gaslight themselves that the laptop isn't real, though you've heard no pushback from Biden Inc. on it, whether it exists or the specific contents that have made their way into the public domain. But okay. Where is it? You got it?
Do you know where Hunter Biden's laptop is?
Again, I'm not going to talk about any potential ongoing investigation as I sit here.
Do you know where it is?
I'm not going to talk about any ongoing investigation.
You come here and you tell us you follow the facts and the law, but you can't even follow a laptop that you guys have had for 3 years.
We follow the facts and the law, and we speak in open court about our cases.
But you aren't speaking about this. But you know who is speaking about it? The whistleblowers from the FBI who've gone to Senator Grassley and said that you guys purposefully take any information that is derogatory about Hunter Biden and you go and rat hole it so that you never have to speak about it in any circumstance. But the good news is you're not the only ones with that laptop. So Patrick Ho was convicted of bribing government officials in Africa, and he gave $1 million to Hunter Biden. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not going to speak about any ongoing investigation.
Is that an ongoing investigation?
I'm not going to speak about any potential ongoing investigation.
Don't you see that that degrades the country's like belief in you guys when you have whistleblowers saying that you're purposefully rat-holing this information, and then you come here and say you won't talk about it?
For more on this and other topics, please be joined for our weekly conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, how about the conversations that have been had on the Hill over the last week? The testimony given by Christopher Wray, the testimony given by Matthew Olson, for me, doesn't inspire much more confidence that I had in the FBI prior to their testimony.
I think it highlights two real problems in the nature of governance in the United States, and I broaden it way beyond the FBI. One is the obvious one, which we know about, which is people take control of federal organizations and they drive them for political purpose. And we've seen this administration do that in really unbelievable ways that even on the left, people are shocked at the amount of unbelievable, just not even pretending to follow the law. Probably the biggest poster child for that, of course, is immigration and border security, where they've actually constructed a human trafficking network paid for with tax dollars to bring people into the United States contrary to U.S. law. But this other one, which I think the exchanges that you listed really, really highlight, is essentially political operatives inside the U.S. government in there, whether it's Republican or Democrat, who are either operating independently or in concert with officials in the government or people outside the government with an express purpose of driving political action. And Hunter Biden's laptop is maybe the penultimate example. Look, this was a real issue. I mean, the stuff in there is deeply troubling. And it goes beyond corruption. It goes beyond just making a bunch of money. It's do people in foreign governments and foreign actually have influence over U.S. officials? And it was buried, and it was intentionally buried, and it with the complicity of the media, not you guys, but others, and people inside and outside in government, you know, including to me, which is the most outrageous red flag that you could possibly expect, which is this massive letter from all these former intelligence officials claiming that this was Russian disinformation.
Yep.
When clearly that was a design to support the campaign. There was no evidence that allowed them to reach that. And when they released the letter, even before now we know it's bogus, but when they released the letter, we knew that was a bogus thing. So elections change governments, but how do you deal with this thing? And you know, all pejoratively, kind of, you know, people that said deep state and swamp and all that. But the reality is, and it's not just agencies where we traditionally see people of one political side. State Department's a classic example, but now we've seen it, and it's not that we haven't seen agencies do things that were not specifically at the direction of the purpose of the agency, and we can look at things the FBI has done over the years, but this is hyperpartisan and it's endemic, and it's now everywhere, including in the agencies that we used to most respect the most, including the Department of Defense.
Well, and we also have this story. I mean, it just the laptop just keeps giving, even though Matthew Olson won't identify whether or not he has it and where it might be, but regardless. Again, as Gates said, he's not the only one. We're now up to 15 business people tied to Hunter Biden's company who have met with the big guy, who met with Joe Biden when he was vice president.
You know, and I said this from the beginning, this actually did Biden no good. You know, they suppressed all this news and it got him elected. But now when he has to actually function as the president of the United States, it continues to drag on him. It'll absolutely prevent him from either getting the nomination or getting reelected again. I think that's just common sense. And they would have been better off if they just ripped the Band-Aid off and just were transparent on this stuff at the beginning, and it could have all gotten over in the campaign and we could have moved on. I think they made a huge mistake by that, and I think it's one of the good. Here's the good thing about our democracy: the fact that this stuff refuses to die, despite the fact that they hold political power, and they have agents within the government, and this thing refuses to die, to me is incredibly powerful. You know, I was down at CPAC Dallas this weekend, and Viktor Orban spoke, the premier of Hungary. And of course, you know, he's demonized by our administration and the left, you know, for being this massive authoritarian. And the irony of this is, compared to the stuff you've just been discussing, is pretty blinding. I mean, here's a guy that was elected with an unbelievable majority in an election that every observer in the world declared was absolutely free and fair, not even up for grabs. Orban does things I don't like, but the things that they complain about, and then they turn around and they want to pack the Supreme Court, they want to take over federal elections. They have no problem with political agents inside the government pushing a political agenda. You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, who looks more authoritarian here?
I wanted to get your reaction to all the hoopla surrounding Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. First, listen to establishmentarian Richard Haass from Council on Foreign Relations is set up to address the sort of conventional take on it.
This is a crisis not about Nancy Pelosi. It's about the Chinese using her visit as a pretext to put in motion a lot of pre-planned exercises and economic sanctions, almost to create a new baseline vis-a-vis Taiwan heading forward. But I think one of the reasons they were willing to do this is they saw no upside, no potential in U.S.-Chinese relations. People always call for bipartisanship in this country. We have a kind of competitive bipartisanship now when it comes to China policy. Which of the two parties can be tougher on China? Republicans, when Mike Pompeo was Secretary of State, he called for regime change to get rid of the Communist Party. He's now calling for the independence of Taiwan. Nancy Pelosi is talking about human rights and so forth. The president wasn't willing to tell the Speaker of the House not to go, that it would be bad. And I think in large part because he was worried that it would be criticized as appeasement of an increasingly aggressive, repressive China.
Is that right, Jim? We've got both parties being too tough on China?
Yeah, Richard Haass is the kind of guy that would invite Freddy Krueger to a slumber party. Look, how at this point could anybody not understand that the Communist Party housed in Beijing is intent on a world without America, and that somehow the problem here is us and us annoying them or bothering them? They are coming after us. So Haass's view is incredibly out of date and delusional, and I honestly don't know where that comes from. And you know, there's somehow that the Chinese, you know, took advantage of this. You know, these are like the guys at CVS that, you know, open the doors and let the looters in. I mean, we look like the Keystone Cops here. We set up everything for the Chinese to do whatever they wanted, and we look weak and feckless in response. And then we complain that somehow it's, you know, it's the Chinese picking on the United States. I really. Let's go back to the FBI story. It's like, that's more reality.
Well, do you think Nancy Pelosi should have gone to Taiwan?
Look, I think, not only do I think she should have gone, I think members of Congress and speakers and cabinet officials should have been going to Taiwan for decades. They have a perfect right to. It's perfectly consistent with the One China policy. There's no international law that prevents this whatsoever. And by essentially
bowing to the Chinese and not going, we allowed the Chinese to set the norms of international relations with the United States, which is always stupid when you let your enemy tell you what you can and cannot do. And then, and what they do is they just keep raising the bar. It's a crisis because we haven't done it. If we just kept doing it, it wouldn't be a crisis. It is a crisis in the sense that we created this and look stupid, and that the speaker and the president couldn't even get on the same page. But somehow the United States is at fault here because officials are going to visit a country is to visit Taiwan. It's just nuts.
Yeah, and they could stuff their luggage with those semiconductors we need over here. That would help as well. this story in the Epoch Times, 400 million cut their ties with the Chinese Communist Party in defiance of communist control. Do you sense that there's a real movement against the regime in China? I mean, if that number is anywhere close to true, it's an interesting data point. That's an interesting development. Do you see any potential internal threat that the communists face?
Well, when you look at the scale of how many people are in China, that's actually a tiny number. I will say this. I think the Epoch Times is doing some great work and some real reporting. And I think they're a rising and important and very legitimate news source in the United States. So, and they do have really good sources in China. So I'm not really sure what that means. The problem with when we talk about these regimes is they're losing power, are they losing grip or whatever, is by nature, these regimes are designed to be non-transparent. Mm-hmm. Even their own people in the country don't know what's going on. So that's why we're always shocked when they collapse. Like, oh, my God, how did that happen? Because they hide the rot even from themselves. So, does China have internal struggles and challenges? You bet. I mean, we know about the pace of economic growth and real estate and their demographic issues. Is it getting something that's really chronic? I don't know. And can we tell from just their internal, do they get more aggressive when there's more problems inside? People say that. But honestly, all we can really do is respond to what they do. So I can't tell you if this regime is going to be around forever. But what I can tell you is, as long as this regime is around, they will never stop trying to diminish the United States and supplant the United States as not in driving how people in this world should behave, and it should behave in a way that's subservient to the Chinese Communist Party. That is their goal, and they will continue to do that as long as they're in power.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Caravano, VP at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. How tipping is changing. We like to, check in on this because it's an interesting cultural phenomenon, and it's different in America than it is, for example, in Europe, where the service fee is folded right into the menu price.
Right.
And so, there's a different sort of understanding between the patron and the server.
But you got to check your bill. The other night we went out, the three of us, and me, Peyton, and Neli, and they put in surcharges for COVID surcharge. There was a $5.89 COVID surcharge on the bill. And what in God's name is that for?
Yeah, so here's the thing. This is what's happening. A good piece, an inside hook about this. They focus on San Francisco. The model and moving to the model where a service surcharge is included in the bill. No tip is required, or in some cases even allowed, like some country clubs where you're not allowed to tip.
Is that what it's like at your place?
No, but it is like at Indian Hill.
Okay.
Yeah.
No tipping.
So, for example, this is Zuni's Cafe, currently facing a backlash from its wait staff following its transition to a no-tip model a year ago. But listen to the complication here. Each check includes a 25% surcharge.
Okay.
80% of that's a service fee. The rest of the surcharge is the 5% healthcare mandate fee. You know, talk on San Francisco, right, crazy. Of the service fee, 36% goes to the server, while the rest is divided among bartenders, bussers, back of the house. And while kitchen workers are finally getting their due in this new model, seeing pay increases of a third to a half, servers are complaining they're the ones finding it hard to make ends meet now, clamoring for return to the tip outs of yore.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I think this guy, this complicated formula, but at the end of the day, what do people know what they're taking home? So you come up with whatever formula you want. If I'm losing money or if I'm gaining money, then that's the bottom line. They talked to this guy, Lowell Clark, who's a captain at Hayes Valley's popular restaurant, Nightbird. I thought he made a good comment. He said, look, there's something, he said, he doesn't like the no tip policy and this complicated formula I just went through. There's something you feel inside whenever someone is rewarding you for the time that you spend and the things you did for that person and how you added to their experience. Without the opportunity of earning more for a job well done, your motivation is mitigated. I think when you take away the possibility of reward, you diminish that level of pressure, and a little bit of pressure to, you know, go above and beyond improves the patron's experience. Dining or otherwise.
Now, what kind of tipper are you?
You know,
if I can get personal.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I'll cede my time to Mr. Pink to describe my philosophy on tipping.
Come on, throw in a buck.
I don't tip.
You don't tip?
No, I don't believe in it.
You don't believe in tipping?
You know what these chicks make? They make shit. Don't give me that. She don't make enough money, she can quit.
Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But, I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds.
You don't have any idea what you're talking about. These people bust their ass.
Harvey Keitel.
This is a hard job.
So is working at McDonald's, but you don't feel the need to tip them, do you? Well, why not? They're serving you food. But no, society says, don't tip these guys over here, but tip these guys over here. That's bullshit.
Waitressing is the number one occupation for female non-college graduates in this country. It's the one job basically any woman can get and make a living on. The reason is because of their tips.
Fuck all that.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, I'm very sorry the government taxes their tips. That's fucked up. That ain't my fault. I mean, it would appear that waitresses are one of the many groups the government fucks in the ass on a regular basis. I mean, if you show me a piece of paper that says the government shouldn't do that, I'll sign it. Put it to a vote, I'll vote for it. But what I won't do is play ball. And it's non-college bullshit you're giving me. I got two words for that. Learn to fucking type. Because if you're expecting me to help out with the rent, you're in for a big fucking surprise.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro. It's actually, it's one philosophy. No, actually, that's not my philosophy.
No.
Mr. Pink's philosophy.
But
what
I can't stand is every sandwich shop you go to, everywhere you go now, they flip the screen to you and tip shame you into giving them something. Because if you press no, which I found out Justin Kosick always presses no.
Presses no to
for
what?
No tip. So even if you, so say you go to Panera.
Oh,
then they flip the screen.
Everywhere
you go now,
I also,
everywhere, where you're getting, you know, a poke bowl or whatever, they always flip the screen and look at you like, you gonna give me something?
Well, this is the Mr. Pink argument about, you know, we don't tip the cashier at Panera, but we tip the waitress. You know, what's the, what, you know, why? But
why aren't I giving a tip to my Mariano's baggage, you know, guy, but I'm giving the Panera person a tip?
I mean, the tipping is, I don't want to turn this into a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode, but the tipping does get a little bit ridiculous at some point, where if you're like, have to tip everybody to do everything. We should put a, maybe we should put a tip jar here on the studio. Yeah.
We do.
Yeah. But the other thing I don't like, since you mentioned the screen, I don't like those remote, handheld where you stick your card in there. Because then the tip comes up and it's like 20, 22. They can set it however they want. 20, 22.
Yeah, sometimes 25%.
Yeah, 25 or custom tip. And then, but I don't know. And then it's.
They're watching you, looking, lording over you like, tip me.
Yeah.
Tip me.
I mean.
You look like a nice person. You're going to tip me.
I'm a pretty generous tipper. I definitely, calibrate my tip based on service.
Yeah. Okay.
You know.
So if you get bad service, what are you going to tip? 10% or nothing at all?
You have to do a really bad job to for me not to give 20%.
Okay.
You have to almost be antagonistic to me.
What about during COVID when you had to wear your mask to the bathroom and back?
It was but that's not the fault. Unless they, again, here's the
example.
Unless they were like, you know, the COVID police, unless they behave like that. If they're like, look, you know, what do you want me to do? This is the mandate. I get it. I'm not holding them up for that. But if they're like, you know, sir, your mask isn't covering your nostrils or something. Okay. Now we got a problem.
Okay.
So, but it's no. I mean, I'm, you know, I grew up caddying, so that was where I learned about tip culture and became a big proponent of tipping. So, and I try to, you know, pay.
What was
it
the biggest tip you got caddying?
I don't know. I mean, individual. I don't know. Probably when Jordan gave me $100.
That's good.
I mean, that was, you know, I caddied in the late 1800s, so that was big money back then.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
You know, and then, but I mean, if you do like a thing for a few days, like caddying in tournaments and stuff, it's a little bit more. But I mean, an individual round, yeah, probably Jordan give me $100 was, yeah.
Hmm. Did you ever get a picture with him?
No.
Or was that, no, you don't.
Nah, I thought it's a little gauche.
Yeah.
I found, even as a young man, I understood, you know, boundaries, proper etiquette, yes. Mm-hmm. Chicago golf. Tony in Downers Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Amy, you know, Dan, you know, sometimes on the social stuff, I'm a little iffy on where you're coming from. But now that you said your baseline is 20%,
yeah,
I have new respect for you.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, you know, this is something that's been going on for quite some time. But you have to separate it too, because I know you're talking about the Paneras and all that. But when you go into fine dining or other, you know, just casual service restaurants. For a long time, it's been front of the house versus back of the house.
Right. That's exactly what this story in San Francisco is about and the balancing act. And this is something actually that was started in part by Danny Meyer, who owns a bunch of restaurants, including the Shake Shack.
Right. And it failed. And I know of what I speak here because I sold into the industry for 18 years. Not that I'm.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And I waited tables for 18 years in all different types of restaurants.
Okay.
And so it's always been that way. And yes, he tried to do that, and it failed miserably, by the way, because you don't get the quality of help that you're going to get. But now you have, and on top of this, now you have the minimum wage law. So this is really hard on owners of independent restaurants as well.
Yeah.
So you've always had this schism. I don't know if you're ever going to be able to take tips out of the equation because you're just not going to get good service. You're not going to, and it's hard to get good servers now as it is.
Oh yeah.
There's so many places you just can't train them. They don't, it's not like it used to be, but it's an interesting topic. I know the Danny Meyers of the world have tried it. I could see more and more where you're going to get automatic gratuity on your checks. By the way, the handhelds are a necessity because of the credit cards, because it all has to do with credit card laws and encryption and all the other garbage that goes with that. And so you almost have to have handhelds nowadays.
Hmm. Okay.
But it's a large topic. But anyway, it's just a lot of information. But that's been going on forever. That's what I can tell you.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I you know, you like the experience where, like, especially fine dining. And so I'm certainly inclined to give more, where you clearly have somebody who's knowledgeable. And so you learn about the food, you learn about wine, they help you select a wine, something like that. I mean, this is where the experience goes in, which is why I like the incentive, which is why I like zero baseline. And I want some service fee that's getting embedded with all these splits and God knows what. Just, you know, you figure it out. I mean, this is my preference. I'm not talking about a law to tell people how to run their businesses or price their items. But I'd rather just keep it clean. You know, whatever the prices are that you build into the cost of a food or a beverage, fine. But keep the baseline nice and clean, because sometimes you forget and it's like, what is the percent? I don't want to look at it. I don't want to think about it. I'm like, wait, is this how much is so 20? Is it 25%? They do this at one of the clubs I belong to, too, where that service fee is included, and I always forget. So, like, you're tipping on the tip.
No, on the tip, right.
It's sort of like, yeah. And so, I mean, and it's not a big deal, but it's just, I don't know. I just like to keep it clean. So I know, you know, I can do simple math after I've had too much wine. Len at the Merck.
Good morning. So I can tell you some of the great stories of tipping and the bad stories between caddying. And I was an outtrade clerk at the Merck for 30 years before I became Len the caddy. And I was actually very good at what I did at the Merck. And I can tell you about getting $25,000 in an envelope at Christmas time from one guy.
Yeah, well, that's real money.
But believe me, I saved them more than that over the year.
Oh, I'm sure.
And over the years, because, there's some tricks to the trade down there. But on the golf course, I mean, it's amazing. I started caddying at age 44 when the Merck started going computer, and it was the greatest thing I ever did in my life. And my forte on the golf course is taking a 25 handicapper in matches and getting the strokes and beating everybody's butt. But
okay,
there's not many complaints. I can tell you Ditka, I've caddied for over 100 times, was really generous, tough to work with.
Yeah.
Jordan, the group I was with, I've had him 6 or 7 times. I didn't get paid personally from Jordan, but I always made a ton from, because they divvy it up, and I always made a ton on that.
Well, you're getting paid by Jordan because he's probably losing like 150 grand during the round. So you're getting paid by Jordan.
Don't tell us the story.
But what leaves a sour taste in my mouth, I deliver food in Highland Park. And, last night, for example, I went to Riverwoods, $150 order. West side of Deerfield, another $100 order. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm going to get taken care of. I made a total of $9 between the two orders, in $3 million houses. Then I go to Highwood to, a working family, and I get a $20 tip on a $30 order. People don't understand that, we're paying $5 a gallon gas.
Yeah, right.
And right now I'm waiting to get my brakes done in Waukegan, the wear and tear. And some people are they're not oblivious. They're just cheap. Anyway, I'm looking for, we got to have you in September.
Well, just send me the dates. I want to play. Yeah. And I want to see if you can turn this, what am I now? I'm like a 3 or 4 to turn me into scratch.
You're a 3 or 4.
Yeah. I mean, my index is like 2.8, but it's going up. I'm in a valley right now. So let's see what you can do with me, Len. Let's see what you can do.
I can guide you around the course and read your putts, and I'll get a feel for what you do. I may not say a word to you the whole round.
You're going to have to make my putts. You're going to have to. That's part of the problem. Thanks for the call, Len. Appreciate it. You know what? Something else I like to. If you interact with somebody that you tip like a daily basis, like valet at my garage.
Okay.
One of the things I like to, I just like give them like a week's worth of the tip up front. So I'm not, because part of that is like you have to do cash, right?
Right.
So I'm always, hunting around for $10
just keep it for the week.
I mean, I only deal in hundreds. So, it's just difficult to get those broken all the time.
Dan Proft problems. Yeah. They are problems. They're just different than some of us.
We all have our problems.
Exactly.
That's the point. Richard in the South Suburbs.
Yeah, hey, Dan and Amy. Yeah, Dan, you mentioned Michael Jordan, but another former Chicago Bill Bull, Scottie Pippen, was a trendsetter, also known as No Tippin' Pippen.
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad rap either, from what I understand. Thanks for the call, Richard. Verlon, Southside.
I'll never tip unless I'm being served. I have no problem with looking the cashier in her eye, pressing the no button, and telling her, this is takeout. I'm not going to tip the restaurant twice because they already get gratuity. Period.
All right. Okay. Thanks for the call, Verlon. Greg LaGrange.
Hey, good morning, guys. Special conditions on mine. I'm a single guy. Mom and pop places, okay? I don't go out. It's not pickup. I'll give them up to 50% because my mom was a waitress. And I know them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't problem giving it to them, and they do a good job for me. Okay, it's all predicated on the job, but I'll give them 50%. I'm a single guy, $20 bill, $10, easy. You know why? Because they have it hard.
I always think that too, like breakfast. If you go to breakfast, it's $20, so you're going to leave like $4. I mean, that's 20%. It feels like it's not enough. You know,
it's plenty right. people.
I don't know.
And if what's wrong with you people?
No, no. And if I go to a place that I'm not familiar with and it's the mom and pop, maybe I won't give them 50%, but I'll give them a third, more than a third. My mom was a waitress. It's a hard job. And you know what? We're in a time where people like that are being pushed to the limit and their jobs are being pushed to the limit and they're being pushed to the limit. They deserve a little break too. I've been lucky. I can pay out a little bit more, and that's the way I'll always be, and I'll always pay cash. I always avoid the credit card.
See, ladies, Greg in the Grange, big spender, single. All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. I like it. I like the attitude. David in Winnetka.
Yeah, hi. I worked in the service industry as well, and my first job was caddying, and my family had a restaurant that I worked for and blah, blah, blah. But I work for a limousine company now, and I've noticed that just in the last few months, as people's portfolios, wealthier clients are getting crushed, they're so much more tight-fisted with what they give out. And, and here we are.
There you go. Thanks for the call, David.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And so this interview was forwarded to me of Dr. Richard Fleming, who I had not been familiar with until it was forwarded to me. So I took a look. He's a nuclear and preventative cardiologist. And he had some rather startling things to say about the vaccines and about the understanding we have, at least understanding he has. We'll put this to the test against Dr. Marty Makary momentarily. But the risk reduction associated with COVID between the vaxxed and the unvaxxed, is it significant? Dr. Richard Fleming.
Vaccinated and unvaccinated on an absolute risk reduction standard was statistically insignificant.
The absolute risk reduction is somewhere between 0.8 and 1.3%.
And that was known by the FDA and the drug manufacturers before these vaccines were rolled out.
What bothers me, I mean, I watched these FDA meetings for the EUA, and none of the people on the panel raised the question, what's the absolute risk reduction, which is the goal of actually vaccinating people. I watched the FDA meetings for the booster shots, and I don't remember whether it was Pfizer or Moderna. I want to say it was Moderna, but I won't swear to it. The head of their vaccine project said that T-cell response was unimportant. Well, T-cell response is critical because you have T-cells and B-cells, and it refers to where they come from. But the T-cell response, it's called innate immunity, is critical, and it's the first thing that happens to people. The B cells or antibody responses occur several days later. But for the antibody response to occur, the T cells have to be working. And we know from published data, and I've provided documents on this, that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines suppress the T cell response in people that get the vaccine. Not only does the count of those cells go down, but the chemicals that they produce, interferon, which simply means it interferes with the production of viruses, and what's called T helper 2 cells, which are a type of T cell that's critical to help make the right antibody response, all of that is suppressed in individuals who get these vaccines.
So has the vax done anything to reduce infections or deaths?
Listening to people tell me that they're Mr. Science, or Big Pharma saying that it's all about the science, or anybody else saying it's all about the science, I'm seeing a tremendous lack of actual science integrity and interrogation of the science, because when you go into the documents, the EUA documents, and you do the science, you do the interrogation of the data to see if it's really different, you discover it's not. The data is very clear. The science is very clear. The vaccines have not done anything to reduce COVID cases or deaths.
That's a big statement. I wonder if our friend Dr. Marty Makary agrees. Professor Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care as well. Marty, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys.
So what do you say to those contentions made by Dr. Richard Fleming?
Well, first of all, there's been a modern day McCarthyism where you can't talk about this, because if you do,
right,
then somebody might go out there and think, I might not want to get vaccinated. And that's the ultimate measuring stick as to whether or not you're allowed to have a scientific conversation. I think it's interesting. It's a theory. You know, another factor is that the unvaccinated have more natural immunity, because if you just had COVID, you're less likely to go out there and get it. And lots have been saying, hey, natural immunity is pretty good, so it's not as important. So that's another theory. And, you know, we'll let the test of time show. But in my opinion, there was a reduction in those who showed up at the hospital among the vaccinated the year of the vaccine rollout. So I do think vaccines have a benefit in people who are vulnerable.
One thing you said about, you heard the exchange about the boosters, and Alex Berenson has reported on this too, talking about the FDA's EUA on the boosters. Berenson writes, the two top vax regulators, Drs. Marion Gruber and Philip Krause, who announced their resignation in late August 2021 and spoke out publicly against widespread booster shots, they from emails that were FOIA'd, as Gruber and other FDA officials discussed what to do about boosters, they had almost no data on the safety or efficacy of a third shot. Their most useful estimates of vaccine efficacy came not from Israeli studies using the same figures from the Israeli healthcare system that Berenson had begun highlighting in July. As one physician in the FDA vaccine review office complained to Gruber, this is August 20th, of last year. And then there is the question of the data that will support these booster doses. In other words, it wasn't in their possession.
Well, Gruber and Krause, these two top vaccine officials at the FDA, basically quit the agency over this one issue. They felt political pressure to push boosters with no scientific data in people under 50. And to this day, the data to support boosters in people under 50 really is not there. It's barely there for those 40 to 50, and it's really not there. So when we were pushing boosters in young people, we were doing a lot of good for the shareholders of Moderna and Pfizer, but we really did it with no good scientific data.
And what about the testing between 6-month-olds to 5-year-olds? Because I have a friend who just had a baby, and she said her gynecologist told her, absolutely not, do not get your baby vaccinated. What kind of testing did we do on kids that age in a case study?
So first of all, nobody's interested in looking at vaccine complications in the United States. It's almost as if, you know, how dare you look for vaccine complications? Because then people might see there are complications, and then they might choose not to get vaccinated. And that's basically, you know, against this martial law that we have in medicine.
Right.
But the studies, and by the way, Germany has done those studies, and there's serious adverse events after one in every 5,000 vaccines. That suggests that there's 121,000 Americans who have experienced a severe vaccine adverse reaction after the COVID vaccine. And the reality is we all know somebody, right? We all know somebody. But in babies, the study was done, maybe. They did the study, and it showed no benefit whatsoever. It's a very small group of kids, and it showed no benefit. And then they went ahead and authorized it anyway. So why are we even doing studies if you're going to authorize it when the study shows nothing? And the reality is you won't hear this from the mainstream media or from the medical establishment, but a survey showed that 40% of parents say their pediatrician did not recommend the COVID vaccine for their child. And that's because healthy children still do not have a compelling case to get the COVID vaccine. And that's why that recommendation has been out there from pediatricians.
But what happened with President Biden? Two shots, two boosters. He had it, then he didn't, and then he had it again, and he tested positive. I think it was 7 or 8 days in a row. But he felt fine, so why are we still bothering, you know, testing? I mean, the first time he didn't feel good, but the second time he was asymptomatic.
And why are we bothering quarantining and isolating? Now, Biden has enough people around him who, you know, are telling him what he likes to hear and admire him and worship him. People, some people in this country are big fans of Biden. Imagine you're a lonely senior. Biden was in isolation for 17 days. For what? A couple of mild symptoms. He was fine. He was well immunized. He had good treatment, Paxlovid. If that's what we're doing to American seniors who are already at, you know, baseline, most of them suffer from loneliness. It's epidemic. And we put them in solitary confinement for 17 days. That will kill seniors. Oh. And that's forgotten with this myopic approach that we have right now to a positive. He had, at one point, he actually had a negative test. Biden had a negative COVID test. And they said, out of an abundance of caution, we're going to continue to have them isolate anyway. I mean, what are we doing to American seniors?
Yeah, that's a great point. And yet still, I mean, to your point about sort of the martial law on the COVID orthodoxy, still the story doesn't change from Walensky and Fauci at all. It's get boosted if you're in congregate settings, wear a mask.
They are changing their push to boost and to give fourth doses as of last week. Internal communications that I'm privy to have basically told me their strategy now is back off the boosters and the fourth doses for about a month, and then they're going to push hard the fall booster. Yes. They pre-purchased a lot of these fall boosters, so-called Omicron boosters, and they are going to be pushing that thing so hard in September that, you know, I think what we have to do as a country is say, show me the data. They're gearing up for the biggest public health campaign you've ever seen this September to push the fall booster. And they're referring to it as everyone has to be up to date, as if it's a software download on your computer. I'd love to see the data. Before you push the booster on me, I'd love to see the data.
Yeah, we're going to have that here in Chicago. Our health director has already warned, like, well, you know, hold off until September when we get this new, you know, it's a new variant. It's going to tackle the latest. But in Chicago Public Schools, so they released their COVID rules for the fall. So if anybody in your class has COVID or on your team, football team, whatever have you, you have, if you're not unvaccinated, you have to test to stay. If you refuse to test to stay, you get kicked out for 5 days. And regardless of your vaccination status, if you've been, you know, four shots, it doesn't matter. You have to wear a mask for 10 days if you're in a class or on a team with somebody who gets COVID. Now, how effective do you think that's going to be?
Well, the studies have been done on masks in schools. They have no impact on transmission. The public health people there are just ignoring the three large studies that all came out this summer. So that's the reality. And by the way, they're going to test kids for COVID. Why are you testing for only one out of 18 common respiratory viruses among children? I mean, what is it with the stigma around COVID? You look at the data now, most kids are immune. 90 to 95% of kids have had COVID. And most Americans have even had Omicron, which is why I'm suspicious about an Omicron vaccine after people have had Omicron. We know the companies have data right now on this so-called fall booster shot. Why not share it? I think they may not be sharing it because they want to ambush us in September. Get everyone all fired up to get this thing, do all the hype, and get everyone ready. And then they're going to ambush us like they did with the COVID vaccine on babies. And then overnight say, oh, it's great. This is great. We got the data. It works. And then we finally go through the data slowly through the massive download of data, and we say, hey, there's no statistical significance here. It doesn't work. There's no benefit. There's zero efficacy. I think that's what we're about to experience with the Omicron fall vaccine.
Huh. You were talking about adverse outcomes from the vaccine. There was this paper from a Dutch scientist out a couple of weeks ago that indicated a higher use of COVID mRNA shots correlated with a small but notable increase in all-cause mortality. It looked at Dutch city and town-level data on vaxes and deaths to show areas with high COVID vaccination rates have recently had high rates of all-cause mortality, deaths of all types, COVID or not. And I wonder if we have still a very incomplete understanding of the long-term impact of the mRNA vaccines, like we talk about having an understanding of the long-term impact of COVID.
Well, you may be onto something there. We just don't have enough data. And I think the people out there who want you to have an mRNA vaccine every Monday morning when you show up at work are ignoring the data, for example, out of Germany. And there may be a connection between the Dutch study and the German study that shows out of every 5,000 doses, somebody gets a severe adverse event. Now, there's all kinds of adverse events out there, from a swollen hand to a blood clot to menstrual irregularities. So, look, if somebody doesn't feel comfortable getting the mRNA vaccine and they have a legitimate concern and they're low risk, let's leave them alone. Many of these people have natural immunity. I fear right now what we're doing is we're creating never vaxxers, because vaccines save lives, and we've got a lot of vaccines in medicine that people need to be getting, and this sort of absolutism instead of using humility is going to alienate a lot of people.
Yeah.
Polio's back. Yeah. I mean, people aren't even getting that.
He is Dr. Marty Makary, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care as well. Doc, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Yes, we really appreciate you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I found this interview with a longtime Democrat in Pennsylvania, just a regular Pennsylvania resident. Her name is Beth Ann Rosica. She spoke with Fox and Friends about switching parties. And it's interesting, too, to note what's happening in Pennsylvania. Obviously, this goes in both directions based on people's predilections, but 39,000, round numbers, 39,000 Pennsylvanians have gone from Dem to GOP. 12,000, by comparison, have gone from GOP to Dem. So there's, you know,
a good number for our team.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, more than three times the number going from Dem to GOP as compared to GOP to Dem. That's obviously an advantage in what could be a very close race for both governor and senator there. And as I said, Pennsylvania, similar to Illinois in the sense you've got a metropolitan area that is hard left, Philadelphia. And you've got the rest of the state that's pretty conservative. So that's not dissimilar to sort of the
Illinois
distribution here. So I'm wondering if you know anyone like Beth Ann Rosica and listen to the issues that are providing the basis for her change and see if you're hearing some of those same conversations. Maybe even you in Lakeview can find a Beth Ann Rosica.
Well, I think that a big part of this trend is related to what has happened in Pennsylvania over the last 2.5 years. We suffered greatly in Pennsylvania under Governor Wolf and his very poor pandemic policies, closing schools, closing businesses. It's been a very tough 2.5 years for many, many families in Pennsylvania.
That
remember that? Remember they
sound
closed,
familiar?
Yeah, but remember they shut down golf courses too? And then they, at one point in time, they shut down liquor stores in Pennsylvania. They're the first ones. Because I remember.
Shut down golf courses here.
I know. Well, yes, but I'm saying then some reopen because Pritzker, lol, thank God he let us play golf with one person in our cart.
Yeah, but do people remember all of the things that transpired, all of the arbitrariness of it? So you could have two people in a boat, but only one person in a golf cart.
Right. And if you lived with three people and you drove to the boat or to the golf course with those people, you still had to split up. Now, thank God, you know, McHenry County and Lake County, they did not enforce that boat mandate that he had put in place because it was stupid. And don't forget that Mayor Lightfoot shut down 18 miles of the lakefront and every single park and every single hoop they covered up or, you know, took the nets down. It was just stupid.
So pandemic policies are informing Beth Ann Rosica's switch from Dem to GOP, particularly because of the impact, as you sort of heard her insinuate, impact on her kids. Of course, now this is being realized by more and more parents. I hope they're connecting the dots. Also matters economic.
I think the economy is huge. And I also think a lot of the school issues for parents across the state of Pennsylvania, it's just been horrific watching what's happened to our kids academically, socially, emotionally. All of these failed policies have just really resulted in academic losses. When you look at the state test scores across the board, kids are not achieving and learning at the rate that they had been previously. So I think that's a big issue. And the economy is huge. When you look at the price of gas, even though it's dropped a little bit recently, the price of groceries, the unavailability of certain items in the grocery store, I think that many parents are just fed up and disgusted with what's happened here over the last 2.5 years, and they want to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, you know, Beth,
are you hearing people like make statements like Beth Ann Rosica that were locked in with the Dems and have now unlocked themselves? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I know someone who used to give money to Quigley on a yearly basis and other Democrats who is now repulsed by anything with a D. She will never vote Democrat ever again. And she's got pretty deep pockets because, you know, she said academic losses, we understand that. But then life experiences, rites of passage, like graduating, going to prom or homecoming, those are things you could be the richest person in the world, but those are things that you cannot get back. And that is what Pritzker did to those kids, our kids.
And lest we forget, we mentioned this last week, but she was just talking about test scores and things. You know, we have measurements on this. And where do we find Illinois 11th graders? The numbers are out.
And it's
proficiencies, meaning proficient or above proficient on standardized tests. So these are juniors in high school. 30% of juniors are proficient in English language arts, ELA. 25% proficient in math. 43% proficient in science. All 11th graders in Illinois, this is where the proficiency numbers are. That's, I think, what she's talking about, what maybe what parents are starting to realize is how far back the kids are. But as compared to where they were pre-pandemic.
We're returning to the scene of the crime, though, again, in 2 weeks from today when we're going to start quarantining people. And most of the people that are being quarantined are the black and brown communities because there's only 62% are not vaccinated.
Well, that's CPS.
So whether they agree to, which is the largest school district in Illinois.
Yeah, but it's only CPS. There are other districts besides CPS. So
I know.
It matters, but it's not the...
Naperville looks
like
they're going to be following
suit. Well, this is the thing. It's a fight district by district, just like it was for, well, just like it's been for 3 years. It's a fight district by district.
Palatine's still deciding. District 211, they're not sure yet. Round Lake, they're still deciding what they're going to do. And it's like, just stop the madness. Let kids go back to school. Make masks optional. Just stop the silliness and stop testing in school. Go back to the old way. If your kid's sick, you take him to a doctor. Send him to a care room.
Well,
comply or die.
Beth Ann Rosica in Pennsylvania has been mugged by the reality of her party's leadership, her former party's leadership, I guess. I wonder what's happening out there in the hustings, if there are many like her.
Well, as a former Democrat for 34 years prior to the pandemic, I, too, thought that the Democratic Party was really focused on the people that they pretend to support. So, for example, I work in the social services field. I've dedicated my career to making sure that, you know, kids in the inner cities, poor kids, many minority families could get the resources that they needed to be successful. And what I saw through the pandemic was that the Democratic Party basically abandoned all of those people. And so that was why I left the party, or as I like to say, the party really left me. Yeah, and I think that a lot more people are really starting to see that. Pennsylvania is very much of a mixed state. So we have, you know, the eastern part of the state, the southeastern part of the state is much more liberal, much more progressive outside of Philadelphia. But the rest of Pennsylvania tends to be more conservative or at least much more moderate. And so there are people across the board who are very, very focused on the economy. And as you said, bringing back natural resources back to Pennsylvania to tap into that pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. 180 of Illinois' 850 public school districts have signed up for SHIELD testing already to keep testing in school.
Mm-hmm.
One district that's standing up, Mount Prospect, District 57, Mount Prospect, they have said, no, we are deciding to move on. We're not going to SHIELD test during school for the new school year.
Well, yeah.
I mean, this is ridiculous.
I thought my party was going to stand up for essentially the people that have less opportunity than I have, and that's not that party anymore. I wonder 39,000 from Dem to GOP as compared to 12,000 GOP to Dem.
Good. God, if only people in Illinois would wake up. Please.
Kevin, Austin, Texas.
So, as you guys know, I'm in Austin, Texas. I grew up in Oak Park, and I actually lived in Chicago and things like that. I still have a lot of family up there, and I feel like they're afraid to talk about these issues with other friends and family. So when I listen to you guys, I feel like I'm listening to Radio Free Illinois or Radio Free Chicagoland, because socially they can't discuss these things. Because of the amount of messaging that comes from the media and over like that, they're afraid to talk about it. I drive through Oak Park and I see more pride flags around 4th of July than I do American flags. And people who run businesses in Forest Park, things like that, they don't want to discuss it because they're afraid they're going to upset the Karens that they come and pay for lunch and go to dinner and things like that. It's amazing how people feel or freely to talk about politics.
So thanks.
I hope that Bailey messages and you have somebody better than this 27-year-old who's running his campaign to start get some messaging out there to get these people to say, you know what, I'll go for Bailey because Pritzker's been so bad.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Thomas Sowell offered a recent column, and it's always nice to see him still writing. He talks about the point of no return. If there's one moment that symbolized our degeneration, it was an enraged mob gathered in front of the Supreme Court, and a leader of the United States Senate shouted threats against Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, saying, "You won't know what hits you." There have always been irresponsible demagogues, but there was once a time when anyone who shouted threats to a Supreme Court justice would see the end of his own political career and could not show his face in decent society again. You either believe in laws or you believe in mob rule. Yeah, that to me seems to be a question that's on the ballot. And it also speaks to what Kevin was saying about people afraid to speak up because of the mob rule that has been given license in this state. Well, again, November 8th in Pennsylvania and Illinois and everywhere else, it's the opportunity to weigh in on that question. Deborah, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I live in District 211 and pay those property taxes. And I would like to know where our property tax money is going, because I know some of my neighbors were at home throughout all of this. And the little amount of time during the day that they actually were required to do schoolwork online was absurd.
It's a joke.
So, I mean, we have to move on. This is absolutely ridiculous, not following science at all.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Appreciate it. Well, any other anecdotes of former Quigley donors that you're flipping to?
I have one, okay.
That's
it? But it's a big one.
Okay, well, it's a
good... Because I thought she would never budge, and now she's just all in Republican.
Everyone counts.
She sold her house. She's out. She moved to Naples. All of you people are moving to Naples.
Well, she's not.
She yanked her kids out of the school. I mean, yeah. She fought. She was part of the Thomas DeBoer lawsuit. She's not done fighting, even though her kids are done.
Mm.
She's a doozy of a story to tell. Oof.
Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. And
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Dan. Listen, Amy is a perfect example of what's going on and what's to come. And here's how what I mean by that. So early on, she was really drinking down that Kool-Aid. No offense to her, because she's a good.
I'm one of the first COVIDians.
No question.
Here's what's going on. She's finally realizing. Listen, these guys at work and everything. I got so many friends and people. They all took them shots, the boosters, the whole thing. Listen, next time around, no way. Everybody's seeing the adverse effects. There's people are getting sick.
Not everybody. No. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, that's the question. I mean, and you know, it'll get measured at some point, but certainly not everybody is there. This hasn't completely flipped. You know, you'll know it completely flipped when you have COVIDian pals like Triple Threat and Jelly Belly no longer talking about it, when they've moved on, when they're not doing performative mask wearing as Jelly Belly was doing this weekend at that bakery at Lake of the Hills. They still feel two things. One, compelled to keep up appearances to justify what they did, and two, that there is political benefit to the posturing that they do. There's no question about that. But it is, Craig is right, and we're glad that Amy got over her, you know, lost in space phase when it came to COVID. Yeah.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.